Vril, The Power of the Coming Race, by Edward Bulwer Lytton. An Adult Brain audiobook production, read to you by Graham Dunlop. Chapter 1. I am a native of in the United States of America. My ancestors migrated from England in the reign of Charles II. And my grandfather was not undistinguished in the War of Independence. My family, therefore, enjoyed a somewhat high social position in right of birth. And being also opulent, they were considered disqualified for the public service. My father once ran for Congress, but was signally defeated by his tailor. After that event, he interfered little in politics and lived much in his library. I was the eldest of three sons, and sent at the age of 16 to the old country, partly to complete my literary education, partly to commence my commercial training in a mercantile firm at Liverpool. My father died shortly after I was 21, and being left well off and having a taste for travel and adventure, I resigned for a time all pursuit of the almighty dollar and became a desultory wanderer over the face of the earth. In the year 18... happening to be in, I was invited by a professional engineer with whom I had made acquaintance to visit the recesses of the mine upon which he was employed. The reader will understand, ere he close this narrative, my reason for concealing all clue to the district of which I write, and will perhaps thank me for refraining from any description that may tend to its discovery. Let me say then, as briefly as possible, that I accompanied the engineer into the interior of the mine, and became so strangely fascinated by its gloomy wonders, and so interested in my friend's explorations, that I prolonged my stay in the neighborhood and descended daily for some weeks into the vaults and galleries hollowed by nature and art beneath the surface of the earth. The engineer was persuaded that far richer deposits of mineral wealth than had yet been detected would be found in a new shaft that had been commenced under his operations. In piercing this shaft, we came one day upon a chasm, jagged and seemingly charred at the sides, as if burst asunder at some distant period by volcanic fires. Down this chasm, my friend caused himself to be lowered in a cage, having first tested the atmosphere by the safety lamp. He remained nearly an hour in the abyss. When he returned, he was very pale and with an anxious, thoughtful expression of face, very different from its ordinary character, which was open, cheerful, and fearless. He said briefly that the descent appeared to him unsafe and leading to no result. And suspending further operations in the shaft, we returned to the more familiar parts of the mine. All the rest of that day, the engineer seemed preoccupied by some absorbing thought. He was unusually taciturn, and there was a scared, bewildered look in his eyes, as that of a man who had seen a ghost. At night, as we two were sitting alone in the lodging we shared together near the mouth of the mine, I said to my friend, "Tell me frankly what you saw in that chasm. I am sure it was something strange and terrible. Whatever it be, it has left your mind in a state of doubt. In such a case, two heads are better than one. Confide in me." The engineer long endeavored to evade my inquiries, but as, while he spoke, he helped himself unconsciously out of the brandy flask to a degree which he was wholly unaccustomed. For he was a very temperate man, his reserve gradually melted away. He who would keep himself to himself should imitate the dumb animals and drink water. At last, he said, "I will tell you all. When the cage stopped, I found myself on a ridge of rock, and below me the chasm, taking a slanting direction, shot down to a considerable depth, the darkness of which my lamp could not have penetrated. But through it, to my infinite surprise, streamed upward a steady brilliant light. Could it be any volcanic fire? In that case, surely I should have felt the heat. Still, if on this there was doubt, it was of the utmost importance to our common safety to clear it up. I examined the sides of the descent and found that I could venture to trust myself to the irregular projections or ledges at least for some way. I left the cage and clambered down. As I drew nearer and nearer to the light, the chasm became wider, and at last I saw, to my unspeakable amaze, a broad level road at the bottom of the abyss, illumined as far as the eye could reach by what seemed artificial gas lamps, placed at regular intervals, as in the thoroughfare of a great city. And I heard confusedly at a distance a hum as of human voices. I know, of course, that no rival miners are at work in this district. Whose could be those voices? What human hands could have leveled that road and marshaled those lamps? The superstitious belief common to miners that gnomes or fiends dwell within the bowels of the earth began to seize me. I shuddered at the thought of descending further and braving the inhabitants of this nether valley. Nor indeed could I have done so without ropes, as from the spot I had reached to the bottom of the chasm, the sides of the rock sank down abrupt, smooth, and sheer. I retraced my steps with some difficulty. Now I have told you all. You will descend again? I ought. Yet I feel as if I durst not. A trusty companion halves the journey and doubles the courage. I will go with you. We will provide ourselves with ropes of suitable length and strength, and pardon me, you must not drink more tonight. Our hands and feet must be steady and firm tomorrow. Chapter 2. With the morning, my friend's nerves were rebraced, and he was not less excited by curiosity than myself. Perhaps more, for he evidently believed in his own story, and I felt considerable doubt of it. Not that he would have willfully told an untruth, but that I thought he must have been under one of those hallucinations which seize on our fancy or our nerves in solitary, unaccustomed places, and in which we give shape to the formless and sound to the dumb. We selected 6 veteran miners to watch our descent, and as the cage held only one at a time, the engineer descended first. And when he had gained the ledge at which he had before halted, the cage re-arose for me. I soon gained his side. We had provided ourselves with a strong coil of rope. The light struck on my sight as it had done the day before on my friend's. The hollow through which it came sloped diagonally. It seemed to me a diffused atmospheric light, not like that from fire, but soft and silvery, as from a northern star. Quitting the cage, we descended one after the other easily enough, owing to the juts in the side, till we reached the place at which my friend had previously halted, and which was a projection just spacious enough to allow us to stand abreast. From this spot, the chasm widened rapidly like the lower end of a vast funnel, and I saw distinctly the valley, the road, the lamps which my companion had described. He had exaggerated nothing. I heard the sounds he had heard, a mingled, indescribable hum as of voices and a dull tramp as of feet. Straining my eye farther down, I clearly beheld at a distance the outline of some large building. It could not be mere natural rock, it was too symmetrical, with heavy, huge, Egyptian-like columns, and the whole lighted as from within. I had about me a small pocket telescope, and by the aid of this I could distinguish, near the building I mentioned, 2 forms which seemed human, though I could not be sure. At least they were living, for they moved and both vanished within the building. We now proceeded to attach the end of the rope we had brought with us to the ledge on which we stood, by the aid of clamps and grappling hooks with which, as well as with necessary tools, we were provided. We were almost silent in our work. We toiled like men afraid to speak to each other. One end of the rope being thus apparently made firm to the ledge, the other, to which we fastened a fragment of the rock, rested on the ground below, a distance of some 50 feet. I was a younger and more active man than my companion, and having served on board ship in my boyhood, this mode of transit was more familiar to me than to him. In a whisper, I claimed the precedence, so that when I gained the ground, I might serve to hold the rope more steady for his descent. I got safely to the ground beneath, and the engineer now began to lower himself. But he had scarcely accomplished 10 feet of the descent when the fastenings, which we had fancied so secure, gave way, or rather the rock itself proved treacherous and crumbled beneath the strain, and the unhappy man was precipitated to the bottom, falling just at my feet and bringing down with his fall splinters of the rock, one of which, fortunately, but a small one, struck and for the time stunned me. When I recovered my senses, I saw my companion, an inanimate mass beside me, life utterly extinct. While I was bending over his corpse in grief and horror, I heard close at hand a strange sound between a snort and a hiss, and turning instinctively to the quarter from which it came, I saw emerging from a dark fissure in the rock a vast and terrible head with open jaws and dull, ghastly, hungry eyes. The head of a monstrous reptile resembling that of the crocodile or alligator, but infinitely larger than the largest creature of that kind I had ever beheld in my travels. I started to my feet and fled down the valley at my utmost speed. I stopped at last, ashamed of my panic and my flight, and returned to the spot on which I had left the body of my friend. It was gone. Doubtless, the monster had already drawn it into its den and devoured it. The rope and the grappling hook still lay there where they had fallen, but they afforded me no chance of return. It was impossible to reattach them to the rock above, and the sides of the rock were too sheer and smooth for human steps to clamber. I was alone in this strange world amidst the bowels of the earth. Chapter 3. Slowly and cautiously I went my solitary way down the lamplit road and towards the large building I have described. The road itself seemed like a great alpine pass, skirting rocky mountains, of which the one through whose chasms I had descended formed a link. Deep below to the left lay a vast valley which presented to my astonished eye the unmistakable evidences of art and culture. There were fields covered with a strange vegetation, similar to none I have seen above the earth, the color of it not green but rather of a dull leaden hue or of a golden red. There were lakes and rivulets which seemed to have been curved into artificial banks, some of pure water, others that shone like pools of naphtha. At my right hand, ravines and defiles opened amidst the rocks with passes between, evidently constructed by art and bordered by trees resembling, for the most part, gigantic ferns, with exquisite varieties of feathery foliage and stems like those of the palm tree. Others were more like the cane plant, but taller, bearing large clusters of flowers. Others, again, had the form of enormous fungi, with short, thick stems supporting a wide dome-like roof, from which either rose or drooped long, slender branches. The whole scene behind, before, and beside me, far as the eye could reach, was brilliant with innumerable lamps. The world without a sun was bright and warm as an Italian landscape at noon, but the air less oppressive, the heat softer. Nor was the scene before me void of signs of habitation. I could distinguish at a distance, whether on the banks of lake or rivulet, or halfway upon eminences embedded amidst the vegetation, buildings that must surely be the homes of men. I could even discover, though far off, forms that appeared to me human moving amidst the landscape. As I paused to gaze, I saw to the right, gliding quickly through the air, what appeared a small boat, impelled by sails shaped like wings. It soon passed out of sight, descending amidst the shades of a forest. Right above me there was no sky, but only a cavernous roof. This roof grew higher and higher at the distance of the landscapes beyond, till it became imperceptible, as an atmosphere of haze formed itself beneath. Continuing my walk, I started from a bush that resembled a great tangle of seaweeds interspersed with fern-like shrubs and plants of large leafage shaped like that of the aloe or prickly pear. A curious animal about the size and shape of a deer. But as, after bounding away a few paces, it turned round and gazed at me inquisitively, I perceived that it was not like any species of deer now extant above the earth. But it brought instantly to my recollection a plaster cast I had seen in some museum of a variety of the elk stag, said to have existed before the deluge. The creature seemed tame enough, and after inspecting me a moment or two, began to graze in the singular herbage around undismayed and careless. Chapter 4. I now came in full sight of the building. Yes, it had been made by hands and hollowed partly out of a great rock. I should have supposed it at the first glance to have been of the earliest form of Egyptian architecture. It was fronted by huge columns tapering upward from massive plinths, and with capitals that, as I came nearer, I perceived to be more ornamental and more fantastically graceful than Egyptian architecture allows. As the Corinthian capital mimics the leaf of the acanthus, so the capitals of these columns imitated the foliage of the vegetation neighboring them, some aloe-like, some fern-like. And now there came out of this building a form, human. Was it human? It stood on the broad way and looked around, beheld me, and approached. It came within a few yards of me, and at the sight and presence of it, an indescribable awe and tremor seized me, rooting my feet to the ground. It reminded me of symbolical images of genius or demon that are seen on Etruscan vases or limned on the walls of Eastern sepulchres, images that borrow the outlines of man and are yet of another race. It was tall, not gigantic, but tall as the tallest men below the height of giants. Its chief covering seemed to me to be composed of large wings folded over its breast and reaching to its knees. The rest of its attire was composed of an under tunic and leggings of some thin fibrous material. It wore on its head a kind of tiara that shone with jewels, and carried in its right hand a slender staff of bright metal, like polished steel. But the face, it was that which inspired my awe and terror. It was the face of a man, yet of a type of man distinct from our known extant races. The nearest approach to it in outline and expression is the face of the sculptured Sphinx, so regular in its calm, intellectual, mysterious beauty. Its color was peculiar, more like that of the red man than any other variety of our species, and yet different from it. A richer and a softer hue, with large black eyes, deep and brilliant, and brows arched as a semicircle. The face was beardless, but a nameless something in the aspect, tranquil though the expression and beauteous though the features, roused that instinct of danger which the sight of a tiger or serpent arouses. I felt that this man-like image was endowed with forces inimical to man. As it drew near, a cold shudder came over me. I fell on my knees and covered my face with my hands. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.